Welcome to the Activation Podcast, brought to you by the Conscious Resistance Network. I'm your host, Derek Bros. In every episode of this podcast, we're going to explore solutions in the areas of health, permaculture, growing your own food, technology. We'll be interviewing guests who are providing important solutions that are more important than ever in this time we are living in. The Activation Podcast is focused on bringing you cutting-edge solutions to empower humanity. So let's go ahead and get started. Hey guys, welcome to the sixth episode of the Activation Podcast. This week, I'm talking with Curtis Stone, formerly known as the Urban Farmer. We're going to be talking a lot about permaculture. We're going to talk about practical tips and things of that sort, but we're also going to get Curtis's views and opinions on the Great Reset and on Agenda 2030 and what it's like to be a farmer in that area, in that realm, and waking up over the last year. And what it's like to be censored and what it's like to just go through that experience. And in the second half of the podcast, the last 30, 40 minutes, we'll be talking about some practical tips. I solicited questions from you guys, the audience, and we asked those to Curtis to get his views and opinions on that. So please stay tuned and enjoy this episode. All right, welcome to episode 6 of the Activation Podcast. And this week I'm talking with Curtis Stone, formerly known as the Urban Farmer, not so urban farmer. We'll see what you want to get called today, man. But thanks for being here with me today.
Hey, Derek, my pleasure, man.
Hey, I've been wanting to talk with you for a good while, and that interest was only kind of just spurred on further after hearing you speak at the Greater Reset. I was really happy that we got to have you on board for our reconnecting to the Earth, regenerating the Earth Day, because it's such an important part of what we're talking about. And today, there are some practical questions we'll get into in the second half of the show. Some of the audience put forward some questions to you that I know you'll enjoy answering. But I want to focus, before we get to that, a little bit on your background and then talk some big picture things about, you know, obviously the Great Reset, some of these agendas that you have started to speak out more openly about through your work. And I want to talk about that journey as well. But before we get into all that, tell everybody a little bit about your background, what first got you into urban farming at first, and then to what you're doing now.
Yeah, right on. It's quite a long story now, because I mean, I've been doing all this stuff for over 10 years, but I used to be like a musician, a gigging and studio musician in Montreal, Canada, and that's what I, at that time, up until that point, made my life out to be. I studied music composition in university and was very serious about being a composer and arranger and producer. But I was trying to have a go at it in Montreal and touring and all that. And I just got sick of that lifestyle and was always into earthships and permaculture and stuff like that. Was reading books about it, was obsessed with it for a number of years before I even did anything with it. I left Montreal in 2008 and I went on like a bike touring journey down in the United States on the West Coast, visiting farms and homesteads and off-grid places and stuff. Learned a little bit, got inspired. That's what originally inspired me to start my farm, Green City Acres, in 2009. And then, started this kind of pedal-powered urban farm. And I was still quite a lefty with my political views then. I really, really had bought heavily into the climate change narrative. And that kind of spurred my actions then. And I don't regret any of my actions, because I'd do it all again. I just think the motivation might have been different. I was more motivated by fear then, in a way. But needless to say, I ran a very successful urban farming business for 10 years. And in those 10 years, the scope of the farm changed a lot. It started small with me just doing it by a bike and trailers. And I was pulling a BCS rototiller behind a trailer and all that. Farming in people's backyards in the city of Kelowna, BC, Canada. And then I got some employees, grew the business, and kind of took it in sort of an arc that kind of what I wrote about in my book, basically, The Urban Farmer. And that's kind of how I got into this stuff. And, you know, all that time, when, like, from the beginning, all I ever wanted to do was live off grid. live off grid, grow my food, try to be as closed loop and in harmony with my natural surrounding as much as possible. That's all I ever wanted to do. And so now I'm doing it, but it's taken me 10 years to build the sort of knowledge capital and resources to actually be able to do that. But where I'm sitting right now, I'm on a mountaintop in rural southern British Columbia, in the middle of nowhere, really totally off grid. And I'm building a 40-acre off grid homestead with about a half acre to an acre of gardens, annual and perennial. I've got water capture here, doing like broad acre permaculture work, essentially. And so it's, you know, it took me all that learning on the farm and doing all this other stuff, and then, you know, having some success with my online businesses that are all related to my agricultural work, to have the capital and time and resources to do this. Cause, you know, if you're just a one man show, you can't really do anything. It's hard to get ahead. And so I have a team that work with me, at fromthefield.tv. That's my main kind of media platform now. And I have two kids and my wife, and with the support of all of them, I'm able to do this. And it's quite an undertaking to do this kind of thing, but it's been a long time coming. So that's kind of where I am now.
Well, it's a really awesome journey, man. And I just want to take, you know, so many things come to mind. The first thing that comes to mind is how similar our journeys are, actually, because I took a bicycle tour across the states as well. And mine was in 2011. And I volunteered on farms and did wolfing. And like, yeah, it was a big part of me, kind of my spiritual journey, my activist journey as well, and kind of making those connections of how important food is. And I have a grandmother who is in her going into her late 80s now, who has a farm here in the States in Kentucky, and she's grown up on farms, you know, always been growing her food, canning, going down the storing, and, you know, teaching me a lot just throughout my life and throughout my activism. So yeah, that's really cool to hear about as well. And yeah, I want to talk a little bit about like what's that transition like going from, because I've done a lot of urban farming as well, working on, you know, a 3-acre farm in the poorest part of Houston that was just a concrete slab that we converted over years, and just, you know, seeing just so much beauty come out of that community activism, food, obviously. You know, I always tell people, like, if you put music and food in a garden and you invite people, it turns into a party. It turns into like a celebration and people want to come hang out. But what's the transition like going from doing like the urban farming to now, like you said, you're up on the mountaintop, pretty much like isolated?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot more variables now on the land. Like, so, you know, it's like context, right? So in the permaculture world, we talk a lot about context, and your context changes a lot being in a completely rural off-grid context to being in a very urban one. You know, in the urban area, there's more social elements involved because there's a lot of people around. At least what I'm perceiving right now, and, you know, almost a year into this is, and, you know, 10 years on an urban farm, is that there's way more physical elements to deal with when you're in this context, because you're totally surrounded by nature. And nature is a bitch sometimes, and you're more susceptible to the downsides and upsides of nature. Like, you know, there's just more wildlife around. I have black bears, grizzly bears, cougars, bobcats, moose, elk, white-tailed deer, wild turkeys. I have like all this wildlife around me. And so there's just so many more variables as far as the natural environment in this context than in the urban environment. Like in the urban environment, it's mostly social. You know, there's things that you deal with when you're farming in an urban context in the natural environment, like you have the heat island effect, which is good in cold climates, but bad in hot climates. Like in Houston, I've been through Texas, and man, it's insane in the summer, and it's really difficult to work and even think straight with that kind of heat and humidity. And so it's just, but in an urban context, maybe perhaps what you might have experienced in Houston is just like a lot of what you do on the urban farm is socially related and community related. There's less to do with the natural world. Like this is what a neat thing about urban farms is, you don't really have to deal with pests very often, not in the same way that you do in the rural context, because there's just less nature in a city, right? That's would be obvious, but it might not be obvious to people who actually really think about it and apply it. But there's less nature, there's less pests, there's less, you have less challenges like wind storms. You know, like I'm on a mountain. Fortunately, I have a lot, I'm in a forest. My main homestead area, my zone one is open, but you know, we get a windstorm and it's pretty intense. In the city, you're protected by buildings. You're protected by all these other things. So, I mean, I could really go on about that for a long time because it's an interesting question you ask. And the more I think about it, it's interesting to actually think about how that those contexts change, but there's a lot of them. But you know, on the flip side, like on the upside, the positive side of it, in the natural environment I am too, there is just so much more upside with the natural environment, like natural water, mountain water, a lot of the things that we're doing with the earthworks design here, capture of water, redirection of water, the air is clean, but it's de facto healthy. Just being out here is just healthier than being in a city. And so it's so different. But it's also really rugged, you know, like you're on your own out here. We've had a couple real scares with storms and stuff, and we don't even have cell service out here. I'm communicating to you via Elon Musk's Starlink internet service, which works quite well. You know, we're on your own. In the city, you have endless amounts of resources regarding things you need, supplies you need, people you need, even energy are all almost limitless. Out here, it's all very limited and potentially scarce. And so it's an interesting dichotomy for sure.
Yeah, I think those are some important points to consider, because making that shift, which is I think what more and more people are talking about and are feeling the desire to do in 2020, 2021, is like, hey, I've been doing some urban farming, or maybe I've never done it at all, but I'm feeling the call to get to the land, you know, get back to the land. And you've talked about liberty on the land and these sort of concepts. And I think it's a shift that more and more people are feeling. And I want to talk about that a little bit more for you personally, is, you know, that going into 2020, and then, of course, here we are in 2021, 6 months in, and things are still just as crazy, if not more crazy. It seems like a lot of people had, for lack of a better term, you know, started to wake up in some ways, and maybe even ways that, like, hey, they kind of were already in a position where they felt like they viewed the world in a certain way. But then 2020, COVID, the response to COVID by governments around the world, all of that really pushed people into like even further into certain directions. I want to talk about that with you. You mentioned just a couple of minutes ago, you said that when you first started, you were kind of more like coming from like a left-wing view, or in, you know, you supported climate change, or you believed in climate change and some of the rhetoric around that. Now, would you call yourself right now? Like, would you say now you're on the right, or how would you describe yourself now? Or you think you're kind of beyond that?
Yeah, no, I'm a full-on bona fide anarchist. I don't believe in the state, period. And so the left-right paradigm, I sometimes just use it because it can sometimes just illustrate an idea that people can understand and communicate with. I'm a liberty-minded guy. I think before I became an anarchist, I discovered libertarianism. I would have never been like a mainstream conservative. There's bullshit on both sides. I'm just a freedom guy. And so whatever that, you know, whatever we need to get there is, you know, all cards on the table, like whatever works. So, yeah, I mean, I'm just like, I don't want to, I'm an agorist really, because I've set my life up to be the least involved with the state as humanly possible. So I'm totally off grid. No bureaucrats are ever showing up on my property. I'm so out of the way that not only are they just not going to show up here, they have no reason to come up here, because I none of my neighbors in this region that I live in can even see my property and even know what I'm doing up here. So I try to just set myself up to be, as independent as possible. And it's really important for me as a parent too, because I'm trying to, I'm trying to raise my kids with my wife, of course, to be as autonomous and self-reliant as humanly possible in a time when we are in the precipice of the full rollout of the New World Order. And that's how I see what's going on right now, is we are in implementation of the New World Order. It's been talked about for a long time. It's like literally the New World Order has been discussed for 100 years in white papers and all kinds of other documents that you can look at from the government. But now we are in the implementation of it. And so I'm trying to do everything the opposite of the New World Order. They want you in cities. They want you using all their technology. They want you, of course, I use some of that. They want you on a vegan diet, eating processed food. You know, we do the exact opposite of the New World Order. And so, yeah, that's kind of...
Yeah, it's interesting because you talked about the reason I ask is just because you mentioned, you know, being like a lefty. But I agree with you that like the left-right spectrum paradigm in a political spectrum, it's only useful, you know, insofar as being able to describe terms, right? Because we need words to, you know, say, hey, this person's kind of this. But ultimately, it is, I think, and I think you would agree, like something that's more used to kind of trap people in like a position of a box. You know, it's like, okay, well, you know, you're even like somebody hearing you, for example, just a couple minutes ago saying, oh, I bought into some of the climate change hoax. Their response, their kind of gut reaction, their cognitive dissonance is like, oh, this must be some right-wing guy. This must be some, you know, whatever they've kind of put in their mind as somebody who says those things, right? And it's just a way, it can be useful to like, hey, sometimes somebody identifies like, hey, I consider myself to be on the left for this reason or that reason, right? Or I consider myself to be on the right for this reason or that reason. It can be useful for that. But for me, I'm with you, man. I mean, I consider myself to be an anarchist. My audience knows that I think it's really something that, especially in North America, has been used to trap and divide people and keep us from being able to work together.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the really what that is all about is the whole left-right paradigm is so low resolution, if you will. And it all is predicated on the assumption that you believe in the state. So if you're a mainstream conservative or you're mainstream liberal, you're essentially the same thing. You believe in government intervening in people's lives. It's just conservatives don't do it here. And liberals don't do it here, or they do it here and they don't do it here, whatever it is. It's all just, it's bullshit. It's just, it's the way that these people, the parasite class who have assumed control of the modern world, give us these multiple choice, sort of like on your high school exam, they give you multiple choice questions where you tick a box for this and tick a box for that. But what if you don't want to be in that box to begin with? What if you don't want to be in that category? It's like Pepsi and Coke. Well, it's still high fructose corn syrup. It's the same shit. And so all that left-right paradigm thing is just a compartmentalization to keep you in the box of, yeah, you can play in our box. You just have to take this one or this one. And so it's a false paradigm. It's not based in reality and it's low resolution. So it's when you really want, like when guys like us can talk, we can understand each other and we don't need to just like fall into those categories. But like, as you said, it's just sometimes useful to do that. And when I describe my previous self, yeah, I was in that paradigm because I didn't know who Murray Rothbard or Friedrich Hayek was when I first started waking up. Ron Paul was, you know, in 2008 kind of woke me up to a lot of these ideas. And then I went deep into all this other stuff and, you know, discovered anarcho-capitalism. And I actually knew who Noam Chomsky was. I knew about anarcho-syndicalism. I was very familiar with that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's just like, you don't know until you know, right?
Yeah. So you mentioned, you said, you know, anarchist, but you also said agorist, you know, and this is something that those who've listened to my podcast, my work, might be familiar with this term. But for somebody who is not familiar to that, you kind of outlined it a little bit with describing the way that you live your life and the way you do your farm. But what does that mean to you? What does that term agorist, agorism work? You know, what does that mean?
Well, to me, I mean, I think the textbook definition of agorism is just trying to live your life with the least amount of intervention or least amount of involvement with the state. I would take it a step further and say, for me, agorism is assuming the most amount of responsibility as humanly possible for your life. So for me, I start with the four nexuses of human survival, which are food, water, energy, and shelter. And so that's my primary goal up here on the mountain right now, like this year: food, water, energy, and shelter. And all these things are under development as we speak. It's an insane process. But that's really what it is taking the most amount of responsibility. And so, even as parents, my wife and I, we have really, taken the ideas, which we really started getting introduced to from a man named John Holt, who came up with this concept of unschooling. There's also, people in the anarchist community like Dana Martin who have really taken those ideas and developed them and articulated them in ways that John Holt didn't, but that's where we started. And so comes into our life there, and the education of our children, and how and who our children associate with and the lives that they, that we guide them in, because our kids are young. Like, my daughter's 4 and my son's 1.5. And so my wife and I really have taken the ideas of agorism into our lives as parents. And it's really important to us because we want our children to be the opposite of what most children are now. Most children that are coming up in the world right now live in cities, live within a paradigm that is completely based on centralization, authority, and control. And there's zero autonomy. And so it's a dependency as well. So I should add a dependency into that. We are essentially, as a species now, I believe we are domesticated animals. And we have been for quite a long time. But now, in this full implementation of the New World Order, we've gone to perhaps domesticated animals that were on free-range suburban pastures to fully caged CAFOs, caged animal feeding operations, you know, stacked and packed in these disgusting, unsustainable, environmental, toxic places. Humans are the same. And so we're doing everything we can with our kids and our life to make our children so far from domestication. We've gone from domestication to free range to absolute wolves where, you know, we can fix things, we can make things, we can do as best as we can. And I have no desire to be a literal wolf, in the sense of, you know, you're just out. It's like the lone wolf thing with the preppers, where it's like, I'm just going to do it all. That's not what we're trying to do. We have community around us, but we're trying to be as autonomous as we can be, so that our kids grow up seeing almost the extreme. And as they mature and start to make their own decisions, they will decide where in that spectrum they want to be. And that's their decision to make. But I feel like, as a parent, in the times that we're in, for me to not give my kids as many of the tools they can be to go out and be leaders in the world, I wouldn't be doing my job as a parent. And so that's where my wife and I are, and that's how agorism fits into our existence.
Yeah, I love that idea of like you saying, show them something extreme, and then, you know, you give them that perspective, and then of course you give them the autonomy to decide, hey, is this the life you want, or do you want to go live in the smart city, you know, crowded, packed world, you know, because they might rebel and say, you know what, Dad, we're going into the city, we're going, you know, there. But you show them the perspective, right? Like, and I think that's important, you know.
Well, they might. I don't know. You know, the whole thing, my wife and I are super into developmental psychology, and it's really interesting when you look at kids who rebel. And why do they rebel? And the primary reason they rebel is because they're not parental orientated. They're peer orientated. And so public school, and this is another piece for anarchists to think about, is the public school system is designed and was designed to be an indoctrination camp by the Rockefellers. They changed the education industry almost 100 years ago. And all these symptoms that we see in society of kids rebelling and all these sort of cultural cliches where, like, you're 16, now you're a badass, you're rebelling against your parents, you don't want to be anything like your parents. That all comes from the fact that parents had 2 jobs because the government told them that they needed both parents to be working to support the family. Kids went into daycare. They went into public school. They spent all the initial years of their life being indoctrinated by the state. And so when they grow up, they're not attached to their parents, and they never were. And they're influenced by all these other people and things around them. And so that's how they get into drugs when they're teenagers, because they're peer attached. They're attached to the next alpha in their little friend circle. And from my wife and I's research and experience with this, because we have a lot of other friends who are unschoolers. Actually, some of them are in Mexico, close to you, or where you were for at least for the Greater Reset. And we haven't seen that. And so, yeah, maybe our kids will rebel, but I kind of doubt it, because the way we structured our lives is that our kids follow us like bear cubs. And so we're not putting our kids in institutions. Our kids are attached to us. They want to be with us, and we want to be with them, and we want to include them in everything we do. And so I think that's a really, you know, guys like Stefan Molyneux, who I don't listen to much anymore, but in his earlier work, I think he contributed some of the greatest work to the anarchist community in talking about peaceful parenting. And that was very influential for me. And that led me on a path. I discovered John Holt, later Dana Martin, even Gabor Mate and Gordon Neufeld. Their book, Hold On to Your Kids, is just an incredible book for even just anarchists in general, to even understand yourself, to think about peaceful parenting, and think about parental attachment, and all this helps you understand yourself. And that's been a really big part of my journey with my wife. And even before we had kids, we were into this stuff. We thought it was interesting, and it's really helped us craft a vision of what it actually means to be an agorist and an anarchist, and actually live that every day of your life.
Well, yeah. And I think that's really important. That's it's important for people who maybe don't think about it in terms of, for one, you made some great points about the education system being completely rigged and just set up in order to indoctrinate people in that way. And I think that is interesting to think about, that perhaps the rebellious stage that we're all programmed to expect through the media is really a condition of living in this dominant society, you know, and it's not just something that is naturally going to take place, right? And I would tend to agree with that. I can say that from my own personal experience. You know, I did get into drugs. I did get into these things. I went to prison at 20 years old, you know, because I just went down that road, and I didn't have my father around because he was into drugs, because his father wasn't around. You know, there's just like this kind of pattern you can see. And yeah, and so I learned, how did I get exposed to drugs? Not through my parents, through the friends and the people that I was hanging around with, that I would much rather, I'm like, I'd rather be with my friends than be around my parents, because there wasn't that connection. And also, I think another important thing is just the sort of loss of ritual that is, I think, a part of kind of growing up and becoming an adult male or adult female, whatever it may be, but just the sense of community. Those are two things that I think could be really powerful, that we have the opportunity, either those who choose to be parents or just choosing to live in community with other children, to kind of raise them in those environments where they have those opportunities. It's really powerful stuff. And I do think that you're correct that people like Molyneux did do some great work in the past. I think he kind of went off the deep end in the Trump years, but he, yeah. But he did do some really good. I interviewed him, I think, for the first time in 2012, like way back then. And it was just like me drilling him with some 101 questions about, like, how do you do this in an anarchist society? What do you do about this? What, you know, and just kind of as I was learning a lot of those things. But yeah, I do recommend anyone who's interested in those topics. I'll put some links below in the show notes for some of the things you mentioned. Really powerful stuff. And I wanted to continue now this conversation, because what I think I'm getting at, and what we're talking about here, is all the different ways that you are continuing to wake up, right? Like, you woke up to the importance of urban farming and growing your own food. You said you started to get exposed to Rothbard and some of the kind of libertarian ideas and an anarchist, and then even further waking up like as a parent, right? And having those experiences. What has it been like for you the last year and a half? Because I've followed your work for a while, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe you've always been as vocal as you are or have been the last like year and a half or 2 years yet, especially about these kind of controversial topics, right? So what has your experience been within the permaculture / urban farming, you know, community, both online and real world, that you interact with, as people have reacted to what you have started to speak out about?
Yeah, man, so it's kind of like, yeah, dude, I mean, it's a really good question, and it's kind of a complicated answer, because I don't, Yeah, like, I mean, okay, so I started with libertarianism. I think I became very savvy to that idea probably in like 2013. And then, you know, I started making YouTube videos around then, and I was just focusing on my farming and my gardening, but I was pretty much into libertarianism then. And then I got really started to just get into anarchism because it just made so much more sense to me. And I'm a philosophical guy. I've always read philosophical types of books. I like ideas, and I liked the idea of anarchism. It made sense to me in sort of a human way. But yeah, probably in like 2016, no, maybe 2017, I started peppering in ideas of anarchism and things like that into my videos, but I didn't go too full on with it. And I think in 2018, I kind of came out of the closet as an anarchist. I think I met Jeff Berwick around that time and was on his Anarchast when he did that. And then I kept, you know, making gardening videos and all that. And then when this whole scamdemic thing happened, I just came out full on because I have been reading. I really had a wake up moment in 2016 when I actually took the government. I basically stood my ground. I had the state come after me or try to come after me on a food regulation thing with my farming. And I'd been learning about the de facto state and the sort of the corporate state of the United States and Canada and the history behind that and why there are corporations that basically just operate under the Uniform Commercial Code and everything in law is commercial and it's all set up to benefit the plutocrats basically. And I learned some stuff about that and I learned some remedy in that. And in 2016, I actually executed what's called a conditional acceptance to this agency of the state that tried to hammer me. And I'd seen in my agricultural consulting practice, I'd seen that done like dozens of times to farmers where government comes in, says, oh, you're in violation of blah, 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 blah. You need to do this. Otherwise we're going to shut you down. I basically stood my ground and learned how the law works and what is law and what is legal and what is code and all that statute, learned all those differences and did some stuff. And it really woke me up because I actually worked and I was like, holy shit. I had this sort of Neo in the Matrix moment where I learned some stuff and then I did it and it worked. And I basically completely dead stopped being railroaded. So then from that moment on, I started to come out. And then when the scamdemic happened, I just fully came out because I knew, because I'd done my research. Like I'm fairly well read and I read a lot of government documents. I learn about how the system works, not because I want to give it any validity, but I'm just going like from a practical standpoint, well, this is it. And if I can do this and this and this, I can at least get them to leave me alone, which I think really follows my agorist sort of life philosophy. And so when the scandemic happened, I just went full out because I knew what was going on. I knew from the beginning, and anybody who watches my live streams that are regularly on Thursday mornings, I called this shit out from the beginning. I knew what was going on. I've read Agenda 21. I've read the document. Like I've been following the white papers of these cronies at the Trilateral Commission and Bilderberg Group. I've been reading these guys like Zygmunt Brzezinski and Henry Kissinger. I've been reading this stuff for years. So when this thing happened, I knew what was going on. And so, yeah, I came out fully and kind of it came from somewhat of a practical and philosophical and spiritual and just doing what's right position. And in 2019, I had a plan to travel through the United States. I was going to go through 22 US states. I've made a career as a content creator. So I don't think that's surprising to most people who follow my work. I actually stopped commercially farming in 2018 and just went fully into being an online entrepreneur. I've been a part of like all kinds of different businesses within the regenerative agriculture space. I was a co-owner of a tools company called Modern Grower with Diego Fuder. I sold my shares back to him last year, but I did that for a number of years, designed tools. Like I'd done a lot of things. But anyways, I've made a career out of being a content creator fundamentally. And I started this platform called FromTheField.tv. And I launched that in the new year of January 2019. And so when the scamdemic happened, I was planning to do this big tour in the United States because that's how I actually was making my living and having lots of fun doing it. I just get in my car, bring my family with me, and we would tour the US, and I just make videos with farms and just showcase the great work of great farmers, because the best farmers aren't making YouTube videos. Like, I'm not the best farmer, and none of the people you see on YouTube are. The best farmers are people that aren't making content. And so I've kind of made that my life's work to visit those people and showcase them. And so anyways, I was going to go do this big tour, and then the scandemic happened, lockdowns happened. So now I'm going, okay, well, shit, I can't do that tour that was basically going to create enough content for me for an entire year. I go do the tour, and then I basically would edit that content and stream it out over the next, 56 weeks. And then I was like, well, this is happening. And because of my knowledge with what these technocrats have been wanting to do forever, I knew that this was it. I knew that this was their full-on Hail Mary move. And so I basically said, well, okay, from a practical standpoint, I can't go and make all that from the field content I wanted to. So what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to start a new farm from scratch, and I'm going to document the whole thing, and I'm going to make it a cooperative. And this is what I contributed to the Greater Reset to showcase was how we did that. And then just from a philosophical, spiritual perspective, I'm just like, this is it. And I would hate myself if I didn't just be honest and say what I think is going on, because to me, my integrity and my love for my children and the world exceeds my desire to censor myself and be and just kind of go along because I want to get clicks and views. And that is a serious consideration that most content creators have, because there's actually a lot of people that you watch videos from on YouTube who are like gardeners and homesteaders, and they're total truthers, but they just don't want to come out because they think it's going to cost them views and clicks. Myself, one of my negative characteristics is I'm slightly arrogant, but it's also been worked for me in some ways. Is I just said, I don't fucking care. I'm going to come out, and if it hurts my business, I don't care. So I did come out, and I offended some snowflakes, but I actually found in that it did nothing but actually benefit my business, believe it or not. Coming out and just saying these things, yeah, again, I offended some snowflakes. I probably lost some viewers and had some people unsubscribe to my YouTube channel, and very few people unsubscribed from the field as a result of that. But the what I've gained as far as connecting with communities like yours and, you and John Bush and Jeff Berwick, people that I've respected and admired for a long time, I'm now way more in that tribe, and it's way better. It's way better. I mean, we're accepting cryptocurrency from the field now. Like, I'm just way more in a community that I'd rather be. And I guess I took a little bit of a gamble, and I wasn't sure how it was going to go, but I didn't care, because at the end of the day, I was prepared to do whatever it took to get through this. And when I originally made that decision to come out of the closet and just say, hey, this New World Order shit is happening, and this is what it is. And I, not to toot my own horn, I've been banging on about it for over a year now. I called out the vaccine ID and all this stuff because I read the white papers. I see the documents. And I took a gamble, but it's worked out. And it's way more fun. I would way rather be doing the work that I love and be hanging out with people like you and people in your audience than what in my urban farming work, to be honest. I was hanging out with a lot of social justice warriors, and I wasn't on their wavelengths at all, but my farming work brought me in there. Like, I used to get invited to conferences at universities all about climate change, all about social justice, and they'd bring me in to talk about urban farming, because urban farming is very much associated in those circles. And it made me want to vomit sometimes. I'd go to these conferences and I'd be like, there'd be some BIPOC person up there white guilting everybody. And it's just like, that's the opening of the conference. And I'd be at these conferences and there was more topics on social justice than there was agriculture. And so I was getting sick of it anyways. And so I'm glad to be here, and coming out there's been no downside to it whatsoever.
That's really awesome to hear about. I can agree with you as well, as far as like the urban farming permaculture space, that I have a good amount of friends in that space, and some of them I think have chosen to just ignore what I do in my work so they we can remain friends or whatever. But yeah, I mean, and I could say, even again, as somebody who is an Indigenous person, that like I get sick of the overwhelming like agendas that get pushed within these various spaces, that like, yeah, there is a lot of interesting intersection and between like people who care about urban farming and, oh, they have different politics than I do. Well, we can still find common ground in these areas, right? But then in some of those spaces, it is overwhelmingly like, if you don't believe this, whatever kind of mentality, this, as you said, this social justice warrior, or, you know, whatever it's about that they're pushing, if you don't buy into that, well, then you're not welcome here anymore, right? It's like you can't just be an urban farmer and say, okay, cool, I have different political views than you guys, and I'm an urban farmer too, we can get along with that. It's like, no, you don't buy into the whole rhetoric, well then you're no longer welcome. And I'm glad to hear things have been successful.
Yeah, you could for a while. Ever since Trump, though, no way. I was fairly open about my libertarian ideas when I was in those urban farming circles and speaking at those conferences and stuff like that for a while. And I even peppered some of those ideas into my lectures and workshops that I did. But after Trump, that whole thing politically divided so many people that if you said anything that sounded even libertarian, you'd have people saying, that sounds like Republican conservative Trumpism stuff. And that's when it became ridiculous.
I think it goes back to the original problem we were discussing at the very beginning of the conversation, which is the left-right paradigm and how many of these different like niche communities and kind of subgroups are still bought into that, right? Like, okay, so I've experienced this, I mean, even in parts of the anarchist community, but definitely in the quote-unquote spiritual community. You know, my work, my message kind of dabbles in both those worlds, trying to get people to talk about like the importance of internal healing and working through our trauma, like in a spiritual and psychological way, as well as confronting and exposing the physical institutions of power. And there are some people who kind of get one side or the other and maybe don't venture into the other area. And I see the same thing. It's like, okay, you get this part, but you have no interest in farming. Okay, you get this part, but then you have no interest in this. And there are some people in all these different subgroups, though, who they get the farming, or they get the spirituality, or they get even like, yeah, there's a new world order and this and that. But in some ways, they're still trapped in the left-right paradigm, or they're still trapped in their own ideological bubble. And I mean, I think we're just at a point now where that all of that stuff, it seems like it shouldn't matter anymore. Not to say that you shouldn't hold on to your principles, because I certainly do. And people should hold on to the principles that they hold, you know, true to their heart, and they should be willing to question them. But we're also facing something that, as you said, is like, for lack of a better term, it's the new world order that people have heard about for a long term. And of course, people hear that and there's kind of a knee jerk reaction, like, clearly this is a conspiracy theory. Call it Agenda 2030, Agenda 21, the Great Reset, call it the technocracy, the plutocracy, whatever you want to call it. There is a ruling class and they are making moves. And at this point, it's like, either we're going to get our shit together or we're going to have a really hard time. And there are people like yourself making moves on the individual and communal level. And there are people, I think, internationally, we've seen this with the Greater Reset. There are people who are just stepping up in different countries around those who are trying to say, how do we work together? How do we take examples from what you're doing in Canada and apply them in India and apply them in Australia and apply them in Mexico? And, you know, a friend of mine put this idea forward to me and he wanted me to bring it to you. And I think it's a great kind of conversation as far as, you know, there's initiatives like the Greater Reset and there's others who are trying to bring people together from all around the world, having discussions and talking about setting into motion plans for decentralization and localization. And obviously farming is a big part of that. But what do you think about this idea of like putting together, and I'm not saying necessarily you leading the initiative, but just maybe it's already happening naturally, but like a mastermind of sorts. It's kind of like a collection of all these various thinkers. And maybe in the best form, we get people from different political stripes to really focus on this. Because I'm seeing even some left-wing people waking up, like Russell Brand, Vandana Shiva, and some other people who you wouldn't really associate with, say, libertarian or anarchist or conspiracy theory or however you want to put it. But even some of that crowd is starting to say, hey, and I see some other independent journalists that I know who consider themselves progressives, but they don't buy into Hillary Clinton. They don't buy into Joe Biden. They're outside of the system as well, and they see the Great Reset. So it just seems like there's a really good opportunity right now for us to, I mean, you've got so much knowledge in when it comes to urban farming and to growing food in those areas. There's other people who are just know the ins and outs of blockchain and, you know, encryption. And just, we have so much knowledge at our fingertips. And it seems like this is probably the time for us to bring it all together. But what do you think about that concept?
Yeah, 100%. I think we're doing that you know, hence, you know, you and I coming together, because I've been familiar with your work for quite a while, and you of mine. And yeah, absolutely. Having said that, I would pose just to be to bring another, maybe focus on something, because you mentioned local. I think what you said is absolutely critical, and I agree. I think, though, what people really should do more so is focus locally. Too much stuff is online today. And that's kind of part of our evolution, technological, human, not really spiritual, maybe it's spiritual in some way, because we kind of connect with people and stuff and realize that there's a lot of people out there like us. But I think there's too much, because I'm so familiar with the agenda of the New World Order, and I've read these guys' white papers and the World Economic Forum and all this, these cronies, is that they want all of us to be on Zoom calls all the time. And I'm not opposed to being on Zoom calls, but like, I think a lot of people in our community, the agorist, anarchist, regenerative agriculture community, you can broaden that out as much as you like. Right now, because of all the stuff going on, people are really striving for connection and tribe, which is good. But I would really encourage people to primarily look for community locally. So it's great that you and I are having this call, and I'm grateful and blessed to be connected with you guys, and you know, John Bush and yourself and guys like Berwick and stuff like that. It's total privilege and awesome. But ultimately, people need to get local, because if you read these white papers and you look at where this thing is going, they want to get you as dependent on their stuff as humanly possible. When I say they, I just mean like the technocrats, the people that provide all this software, all the banking, the Swift, you know, banking system and all this shit. They want to get you as on the hook with these things as humanly possible. And they'd rather you were in cities, because they want total control of you. That's the vaccine is that, the technology is that. And so we need to ultimately start getting local. And so your food, water, energy, and shelter, local. All the trades, skills, and things that you fundamentally do in your day-to-day life, you should be localizing as much as humanly possible, because when the supply chains continue to break down, and they already are, this year has been insane for supply chain breakdowns. Like, I'm a general contractor on this entire project, and it is insane every day, the shit that I have to deal with or that I can't get. I got to make 5 phone calls to get this one thing where I normally could have just got it so easily right off the shelf. This is just going to get worse and worse and worse. And I don't say that because I want people to be fearful. I just want people to be prepared, and I want people to do the right thing and succeed and get through this phase. Cause I think we're in a 10-year rollout where all we have to do fundamentally is get through this phase and also continue to grow ourselves spiritually and communally, and with our bodies and our health. We need to elevate to the highest frequency as possible, because what's coming is going to be even worse. I'll make a prediction right now. In 3 years, we're going to look back at this time right now and say, oh man, those times were really good and easy. Having said that, the higher we can get ourselves in a frequency, and this ties into a lot of the work you do on the sort of spiritual stuff, is that we need to be in a higher frequency to withstand the shock and trauma that is coming. And I think we're going to see massive repercussions from this injection, this experimental injection that people are stupid enough to take. We're going to see family members, close friends, and just people we knew in our community either die or completely change. And it's going to be crazy. And we're going to move into this medical apartheid society where they won't have us, where we're not going to be able to go into the cities for much longer, probably a few more years. But with this vaccine ID thing and the setup of a medical apartheid society, we're not going to be able to be involved. And so people better get used to relying on people around them and making sure their network of people in their immediate circles is very tight and you have a needs and benefits relationship based on like simple economics of I need you and you need me, and so we're better off to cooperate. You need to be like 90% of the time you spend needs to be with people in your community, because it's going to get to a point where there's not going to be much needs and benefits economically of you and I having Zoom calls. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have Zoom calls. We should do these interviews as often. That's not the point I'm making. It's just that people, I see a lot of people in the truth community and anarchist community, they spend way too much time online with like global networks, which are important, but they're not as important as your local networks because of where we're going. So that's what I would say to that.
Hold that thought. Guys, before we go any further, I want to tell you a little bit about a project that I recently launched called the Holistic Self-Assessment Online Course. Now, some of you know that I released this book, The Holistic Self-Assessment, in April 2018. And essentially, this book is the culmination of the experiences I had when I went to prison, dealing with addiction, dealing with depression, and suicide attempts. This is the process that I took myself through to get to know who I am, to get to know my principles, to get to align my relationships, my words, my thoughts, and actions with those principles. Overall, it's meant to be a self-empowerment, self-help guide that can help you start accomplishing your goals by aligning your principles with your actions. The book is available to download for free, and I'll include that link below. But if you're interested, I did recently launch a new online course, which you can find on the University of Reason, aka Autonomy. I partnered with them recently, and they created this whole online course for me. It's 9 weeks long. You can watch and follow along and read the book as I go through each chapter. I read it with you, and I offer some tips and some exercises. There are two different options. You can either do DIY, where you just go through the 9-week course yourself, or if you want to have personal one-on-one sessions with me, there's also an option for that. So check that out, guys. I'll include both links below. Let's get back to the podcast.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, so many good things there, but the way you wrapped it up, it kind of brings me to the next thing I wanted to talk about is the, you know, we've been working on, John Bush and myself, promoting what we call freedom cells for like the last 5 years. And I mean, at the end of the day, it's just mutual aid groups. It's the community, and it's what you're talking about, right? Because yeah, it's great to have like, you know, like I said, be a content creator and have fans in India or, you know, Australia or whatever, but you can't really build a garden with them, right? You can't really, you know, protect your community with them on that level. You guys can share ideas. You can, you know, kind of network in that way. And that's important, but it does ultimately come down to the local level. And that's what Freedom Cells and other projects and other ideas that folks have put forward to in the last few years. And I can say that in the last year and a half, we went from, you know, having people around the world paying attention to Freedom Cells somewhat, but we now have 23,000 people who've joined just through the website, and they're not joining so that they can follow me in Houston. They're joining so they can get access to the maps and they can search and find people in their local areas so that they can find pre-existing cells and groups and hubs and circles and pods, as some people call them, in their local areas, you know, because that's where it really matters. And you've done some of that with, you know, what you're doing now by building a cooperative. But I wanted to see, do you have any tips to for people who are, besides like, you know, going to freedomcells.org and stuff like that? Like, it can be difficult to organize and to do so in a decentralized way, in a local way. Do you have any tips for people who might be looking to get started? Because I mean, we hear this from people often, like they'll join the website and not every area is like a hotbed yet, right? So somebody might join in small town, middle of nowhere, and they're like, oh, there's nobody in my area. And they just kind of wait for something to happen. And we encourage people like, hey, sometimes you got to be the one to get things started in your area.
Yeah, that's the key word, wait for something to happen. The time for waiting is over, people. Like, Freedom Cells, I'm in the Freedom Cells networks, and like at least the ones that are relevant to me in my geography. The most important thing about Freedom Cells is, in my opinion, and I love everything you guys have done with that, it's exactly what was needed at the time, is that you need to get on those networks, but then you need to get off of those networks and stay on it. But it's just like any online community. There's just people who are just posters, and it's just like, in my opinion, just if you're just a poster, you're a poser. It's like, get on there to meet people, and then get to meet them in the flesh. Build needs and benefits, economic relationships with people. So, and we're seeing this too. There's also another community here called ESC, the Earth Stewardship Cooperative, which was started by a friend of mine, Dean Clifford, who's like a fairly legendary kind of sovereign free man dude here in Canada, and he's built a similar network called ESC here. It's like, yeah, get on those to meet people and then immediately look at ways you can economically be involved in there. So if you need a tradesperson to do some carpentry work for you, first go to Freedom Cells and ESC. Go on those communities, get involved. And, you know, I want us to, the reason I bring in economics into it is that it's the easiest way for us to work together. So it's like, if you need a service, do it with a person in that community and get to know those communities. You have to start. And it's just like, if you're just sitting there posting links to these groups, you're wasting your time. You're wasting your time. Those groups should be a tool. Use that tool to get those people in your local network and then get those people involved in your local network. And you do that through work. So whether it's cooperating to build some gardens or maybe meeting a group of people that you want to buy land with, or maybe you need to hire trades guys. Maybe you're looking for work and you want to work with other like-minded people. The thing is, you got to get involved with them offline because there's a major black swan event coming with this stuff, I believe, because the CEO of Telegram sits on the World Economic Forum. And so, you know, we're all using these Telegram groups and that's all great, but this might be a big honeypot. I don't know. The important thing is that you got to have those relationships offline, because if you all you have is Telegram and is your way to communicate with people or Signal or whatever it is you're using, and you only know those people online, when they do their next Hail Mary move, you're going to be completely isolated and you're going to be wishing you had people around you. And so, yeah, the main message here is get to know people offline primarily. Use online as tools. Yes, it's all good. I do it too. But you need to primarily have community around you that you know and have other ways to communicate with them, either offline or just, you know, like ham radios, you know, like we have ham radios here. There's, you know, you need to have these things because we all know about the cyber pandemic, right? I'm sure everybody listening to this and your audience knows about it. And that's going to continue. And they're going to continue to break down other things. It's all written about. They've talked about this stuff forever. They're going to keep breaking down supply chains, food systems, communication systems. They're going to bring people to the cusp so that they go to get the injection. And that's why I even tell people, get out of the major cities, because it's going to get to a point where they're going to economically get you so pigeonholed that the only way you can get food is to go stand in a bread line. But in order to stand in the bread line, you need this injection, and this injection. And then you need to have that thing on your vaccine passport that says you can go here and here and here. That's where this is going. So yeah, that's what I would say to that.
I mean, you're right. And this is, to me, it's like, this is why people who've been hearing myself and plenty of others talk about local organizing, growing your own food, et cetera, and the last year have just gravitated like, okay, it's time to do that. I'm ready to do it. You know, because when we feel threatened, all of a sudden we're ready to move and act. And I really hope that some folks, depending on where you're at in the world, if things are kind of going back to normal, that you don't let yourself be, you know, kind of don't slip back into comfort of like, okay, well, they kind of backed off. Like, no, you should use this. And I've been saying for the last year that COVID-1984 has been a huge motivator. It should be a motivator for people to get their shit together. And like you said, even with Freedom Cells, we always tell people, like, I can't emphasize enough, this is not a place to post links and to talk about your post cat memes and this and that. Like, find people, connect with them, get offline. And as you were saying, build, because that is going to become increasingly important, especially with, you know, just, we're recording this on July 10th. On July 9th was the Cyber Polygon exercise by the World Economic Forum. So they're simulating what's going to happen when the supply chains go down, when the power grid goes down. We should be paying attention to these things. So I would definitely recommend people don't allow yourselves to slip back into comfort and complacency and continue to push. I know you're a busy man, but if you have time, I have just a few more questions from the audience. These are more on the practical side of things, like some questions related to, you know, how you run your project and things like that. So let's slip into that segment here. These two are kind of related. One of them was, somebody was just curious if you've run into, maybe just you could speak to over your whole career and involvement in urban farming and now what you're doing, but maybe particularly to where you're at, since you said you're pretty isolated, Do you have any issues? I think you kind of touched on this earlier, like with the state coming to bother you. Do you have to deal with permitting issues, or is that not a thing where you're at? And kind of in line with that, are you able to maintain water independence?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So we're totally raw dog up here. Permits, things like that, those things are irrelevant to me. And you will find that most people in isolated communities are actually just agorists by de facto. They won't articulate that philosophy. They've never read Rothbard or any of the sort of, you know, anarchists, anarcho-capitalist thinkers, but in their actions, they already do that. And so that's much of what it's like up here. I also know enough about the law now that I know how the commercial system works, and I've got remedy for myself. I'm not a remedy guru. I don't write paperwork for people. People, please don't email me on how to get out of your speeding ticket. Like, I don't do that for people. You have to figure that thing out yourself. You have to go through the gates yourself. So yes, we're totally free of that. But with that, let me point out that also comes with associated risk. So it's one thing to like not get a permit for your house or whatever, but doing that also means you can't get insurance either. So the state provides privileges and benefits. It takes away rights and freedoms, and in exchange gives you privileges and benefits. It's like, I'll take your gold and then I'll give you fiat currency. That's kind of what the state does in terms of protection. That's how it is here. And everybody who lives in this area, it's the same thing. Like as I got to know all my neighbors, it's like, oh, I built this, I poured this slab, no permits, no nothing. That's the benefit of being in the country. And water independence, absolutely. Yes, we are 100% water independent here. We have a number of water solutions. My primary water solution that was set up on this land before I got here was it's a pit well. It's basically a well that's in a big culvert. It goes down 8 feet in the ground and it captures snow melt in a sort of a sandy area where there was a natural draw where the water would flow as the snow melted. And then we have a 40,000 liter cistern that we've been pumping from. So we get that water. We drink completely 100% glacial or water or snow melt water up here. My other water is my neighbor's well right now. We're using that, and I'm drilling another well up here, and I'm hoping that I hit the water dowsing. I'm making a video about it. And then we're going to drill another well, but I'm also in the process of developing two ponds up here that can hold about 1.2 to 1.7 million liters each. So we'll be able to have our own, perhaps hopefully 3 million liters of surface water stored on two different ponds that are within the primary 8 acres of this property. And then hopefully we drill another well and hit pay dirt, but we'll see. But yeah, that's absolutely, water independence is so important. On the subject of water, it's really interesting. I've been doing a lot of research about groundwater, and the way I do research is mostly offline. So the way I research things is I talk to experts. And I seek out elders who have experience and I talk to them. That's how I've always done research. I just go straight to the gravy and I just talk to people who've done it. I've interviewed just privately about over a dozen people who have been well drillers and just water people in the country who've been doing this for like 30, 40 years. And it's really interesting what I've learned about groundwater. And I think everything that we've learned about water from high school is bullshit. And there is the world as we know it, because I think everything the state has told us is a lie, essentially, and it's been motivated by their own self-interest. But all this theories of like, and I'm not a flat earther or anything. I'm not opposed to that idea either. I don't really have a stance on that thing one way or the other. But I just do think that everything we've been taught is bullshit. And there's this new theory about water called primary water. And it basically states that the earth creates water through crystallized hydrogen and oxygen. And you could go and look that up and learn more about it. Don't rely on me for your first knowledge about that. But it looks like the world that we live in creates an infinite and abundant amount of water, which, if that is true, completely challenges the paradigm of the economic scarcity, top-down pyramidal structure that is imposed on us. Because if we had an abundant source of water everywhere, there's no reason why people are in Africa are schlepping, you know, water in buckets, you know, 20 miles a day. And that's what's been neat about this research I've done. And what I'm is like, I've been talking to all these well drillers who are like, yeah, none of us really totally know how this works, because we'll drill one area and it'll be a duster, and then we'll drill 10 feet over and it'll be a gusher. And so nobody really knows how it works. But one thing I've been learning is that the higher you are on the mountain, the actually closer you are to water in the ground, because water on the surface goes down in valleys and sediment drags it down. And when you're on lower elevation, you're at lower sediment levels, you have to drill deeper. Whereas on mountains, I've talked to so many people that have drilled like 30 feet on a mountain and they have infinite water. It's really interesting. And I always like to look at these things and, you know, look at the past and how we've been lied to. And I find it interesting. But yeah, water and all that is 100%.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I'll have to look into that myself. It's not something that I'm too familiar with, but I do agree with you. And you know, it's hard to trust anything once you start to recognize how many things we've been lied to about, right? And sometimes people can go off the deep end with that, I think, and you can't trust anything anymore. But I can understand, because like you said, I mean, maybe we really are, from what we know, we are living in a world with abundant energy sources, and we're lied to about that. And that creates a mentality of scarcity. We're told that we are on the brink of water wars in the coming decades because of water scarcity. You know, so there does seem to be a lot of reason that somebody might, you know, put that perception out there. So the next question I got for you is, what is a more viable solution to feed a small off-grid community if you compare between hydroponic crop production versus traditional gardening? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm not that into hydro and aquaponics because it's totally reliant on a lot of inputs and things and infrastructure that in a collapsed society or scarce economy are just not available. So, on my spiritual side, I believe God created us and the earth and all the abundance. I find it hard not to be spiritual when you live in nature. That's been my experience, because nature, which is God, is so infinitely abundant. Just look at a seed and how a seed produces a plant and then a million other seeds. And then it's this exponential abundance. And I find that the more I learn and interact with nature, And so I don't see any reason to do any other type of growing besides in God's soil. And even when you get into the scientific arena of it and, you know, looking through our limited perception, but what we can see in growing in the soil versus growing in hydro or aquaponics is that the soil has an almost infinitely complex ecosystem that benefits us nutritionally, I think, beyond what we actually even know. You can look at the work of Elaine Ingham, Soil Food Web, and things like that, and you can see this absolute expression of beauty and abundance in the soil. And so for me, just on that alone, I don't see much reason to do hydro or aquaponics. I mean, I understand that people who live in extreme climates might not have other ways, and I respect that. And I think you got to do with what you got to do ultimately, what makes most sense for you in your context. You know, I've traveled a lot in the tropics and done farming consulting in the tropics. I've also been in northern regions of Canada, which I do see those two as extremes. You know, in places like some places in Mexico, there's so many nematodes in the soil. And you'll find this if you talk to farmers in Mexico. Like, they just can't grow annual crops in soil because things just get devoured by pests, disease, and you know, negative type of nematodes. And there's solutions for all those within nature, don't get me wrong. But sometimes just the easiest and quickest solution is just to grow in hydro. I get it. Same in the northern regions of Canada where it's extremely cold, and how else are you gonna have fresh food in the winter locally? You know, that might be your only option. The only problem with these things, they put you dependent on systems and materials and plastics and things like that. And I'm not shaming any of that. It's just, I just look at it from a practical standpoint with where we're going right now with this false scarcity that's being imposed on us, I don't see a lot of upside to just doing that stuff. Use God's soil. The soil is meant to grow the things that we eat. It's how everything is. The sun creates life. The sunlight and water create the elements that soil needs to thrive and grow all these things that naturally nourish our bodies. I just don't know why anybody want to do anything different. And context is the most important thing to put through the lens, is that in the tropics, you don't need to be growing annual vegetables based on the North American Western standard diet, because those things don't actually want to grow very well in the tropics. Like in the tropics, it's very difficult to grow a crop like carrots or spinach or romaine lettuce, because those things don't naturally grow down there. And so if you want to work within sort of a permaculture paradigm, do what makes sense in your context. In the tropics, there's so much natural abundance. It's actually in the tropics, it's more beneficial to have an agricultural system that leans more towards a horticultural system. Horticultural meaning that you are sort of a steward to what's naturally happening, and your diet is more based on perennials. Whereas in the cold climates, which Western Europeans brought, you know, agriculture to, there is a lot of natural perennial abundance here, but our season is so small that we do rely on agricultural systems to grow annual crops and things like that. So it's just follow your context. Look at indigenous cultures, which I have so much reverence for indigenous cultures, because there's so much natural wisdom in there that connects the creator to the earth and soil to us, that I just always look at those things to, like, what did they do? What did his indigenous cultures in Canada, which is just a, you know, a fake border, but just to describe the geography of where I live, what did they do? And then look at the tropics. What did indigenous cultures do in the tropics? And perpetually use that through the lens. And I think more people in the regenerative agriculture movement need to start looking at that. And this isn't some kind of like social justice virtue signal. It's just totally from a straight up practical standpoint. Indigenous cultures had a lot of wisdom that we can use to live on this earth without supply chains. And that's just straight up practicality.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're correct, right? It doesn't have to be a virtue signal to acknowledge, like, that there are civilizations and cultures who've come before us all around the world who have taught us things and left behind knowledge. And there's a reason that knowledge was, attempted to be completely wiped out, exactly, from colonization and whatnot. So, and the other point you brought up that I think was really important is that, and this is, you know, one of the first things that my grandmother, who I mentioned earlier, who's been growing up, living on farms and still lives in a farm and probably in her garden right now, when I first started to get involved in this, like I told you, I went on a bike tour myself in January 2011. When I came back, after spending 3 months on the road, just volunteering on farms and just, you know, meeting beautiful people every day and working on like a small half acre homestead to a 300 acre farm and everything in between and just learning so much. When I came back from that trip, I was starting to tell my grandmother about this. I was like, oh, grandma, I've been getting into, you know, learning about farming, and I'm doing now this urban gardening. And I actually started a business for a while, just building gardens for people around Houston. You know, I did it in an agorist way, never got a business license, just word of mouth, started doing the work. But I remember my grandma telling me, you know, she said, when you start getting closer to the food and to the earth, she's like, in the more time you spend in the garden, you're going to get closer to God. And she said, and I'm not talking about religion, which I thought was really cool, because I've had issues with religion my whole life, but you know, I understand the creation. But it was just really beautiful because she told me that, and I remember telling her, like, grandma, I'm already experiencing that, like, I'm already feeling like more connected to the earth. And like you said, when you're out in nature and you spend less and less time in the city environment, or even if you are in the city but you're spending plenty of time tilling the soil with your hands in the soil and working with the plants and from the seed to cooking for somebody, there's something special that does happen, and it's a transformative experience. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
It is a transformative experience. And you know, from what we know with our limited perception, I think a lot of it, at least just based on my observation, what it comes down to is that our bodies are electricity and water. And so much energy resonates through those things, through water. And the soil is this grounding mechanism. And, you know, people talk about grounding, you know, like being there and, you know, walking on it. And for them, it's just kind of a thing that you do okay, I work my 9-to-5 job on a computer all day, and then I go and I stand barefoot on the ground for an hour each day. Well, for me, I work with my hands in the dirt every day. So being grounded is absolutely, completely encompasses my existence. And that's why I think there's so much benefit to people just doing some kind of work on the earth. And you're going to have to get used to it anyways, because, you know, like you mentioned, cyber polygon, cyber pandemic, all this stuff that these controlling parasite elite want to do is they want to flipping of the script, if you will. And that they're hoping that that's going to disorientate everybody. And, oh my God, I can't go on Zoom every day, or I cannot be on Facebook anymore. What am I going to do? It's like, get on the earth, get your hands in the soil,
go outside,
start doing stuff offline, like significantly. Like, again, all these tools are good and we use them. Like, don't let them control you. And the more you will, like, it's quite an interesting experience. Like, how you articulated it is exactly what I experienced, because I used to be a hardcore leftist atheist. And now I've completely, that paradigm no longer means anything to me. Every year that I worked in the soil, and especially as I started engaging in more rural type communities, and I did that through my consulting work, because I spent a lot of time in the U.S. just consulting for non-urban farms. I became just kind of a market gardening consultant, you know, and I worked with market gardens. It wasn't really about urban anymore. And I just felt more and more that sense of spirituality. And it wasn't anything about religion. It wasn't anything about anything dogmatic whatsoever. It was just like hands in the soil in the country and being around people who live like that completely just changed me. It was actually people in the deep South, actually. It was spending a lot of time in places like Tennessee and Florida, and just meeting more rural people totally shook my paradigm. Because in Canada, Canadians are very propagandized about anybody who isn't Canadian, just like everybody is. Americans are propagandized about Mexicans or anybody who's not American. So it's no different here. But in Canada, there's this perception about Americans, particularly Americans in the deep South, that are just like hillbilly. You know, think of like the movie Deliverance, just this perception that Americans are these like right wing backwoods, you know, super Christian conservative idiots. And I found when I traveled in the United States in those areas, the opposite to be the truth. I found people in the deep South, and I find this actually, to be honest, everywhere I travel, everything you hear about a place, it's bullshit. It's all propaganda, because they want you to stay in your cage, right? The state is a cage. It's a caged animal feeding operation. It's just a farm. It's just an industrial farm. That's all cities are. That's all nation states are in a way. And you get out of that and you realize the incredible freedom and beauty that exists in the reality of how people are and the diversity that exists within people. And I just like, it changed my life when the more I went to the, and it wasn't anything to do with the states. It was just like the places and the people that I met in the country were just so switched on. And they were just such people of action and such people of faith and such people of humanity and such people of spirituality and understanding that everything I thought in my university academic circles of like sort of, you know, intelligentsia liberals that think they're so damn smart because they have a degree in XYZ. Then you go to the country and hang out with all these rural people who the people in the city think are uneducated backwoods hillbillies. These people in the country are just like way more smart, way more resourceful, and way more loving, and way more forgiving, and way more accepting than all these liberals think they're so great at. And it totally changed me and set me on a path that has led me here, basically.
Wow. Great, great stuff. I appreciate you sharing that. I got two more quick questions for you. One is just, what are your thoughts on Humanure?
100%. That's what I do here. The Humanure Handbook by Joseph Jenkins was actually the first permaculture style book I ever read. The next was Michael Reynolds' books on earthships, and then the next was Bill Mollison's tome. But absolutely, Humanure, 100%. We do right now, what I'm doing here is a combination of Humanure with the Johnson Tsu bioreactor. So we do sawdust toilets up here. My crew, everybody up on this land, we all do sawdust toilets. We have a mill that will be producing a lot of sawdust soon, but we're also close to mills because, you know, rural British Columbia, you know, you're you're near a lot of mills. So I have an endless supply of sawdust and that I can easily get. And so, yeah, we do sawdust 5-gallon bucket toilets, and you poop and you pee in there, and you cover it up with sawdust. It's an amazing system. There's no smell. And then I've built a large bioreactor. It's about 5.5 feet tall. I have two of them that cycle. And so we basically poop and pee in 5-gallon buckets for about a month to 6 weeks. We have I have a large stockpile of these buckets. And then once a month or every 6 weeks, depending on how many people are pooping and peeing, I go and I did it yesterday. I just turned over all the buckets yesterday. And in this big bioreactor. Bioreactor is a really cool way to compost because it's like this super high-paced aerobic composting. And so all that stuff goes in the bioreactor. There's these PVC tubes with sewer piping with half-inch holes in it that go into this giant tube. And you stack up 5.5, 6 feet of compost. And then these tubes that go into it allow oxygen to get all the way through. And so you get this super high frequency aerobic composting, 55 to 60 degrees Celsius. And then you get this incredible compost. And so I think for off-grid, humanure is an absolute must, especially if you're not doing ruminant animals. And our context up here on the mountain, we're very limited on what we can do with animals. Like, I'm a huge fan of animal agriculture, and I support that, and I want to do as much of that as possible. But my context up here is I'm on a rocky mountain face with limited soil and limited grass. And so I can't do cows up here. And I think cows are great. I think manure is great for farming. But I have a limited context up there. So for me, humanure is more important than, is one of the most important systems we have up here. One is I don't want to contaminate my groundwater with a septic system, and I don't like septic systems. They're reliant on technology. It's also next to impossible for me to do septic up here because I'm on bedrock. Like, I have no soil, so I have to create soil. And so I get this sort of double whammy benefit of humanure because, one, I make my own soil, which is incredible soil. It's like some of the best soil you can make, super potent, turns into pure worm castings eventually. And two, I just don't have a place to do a septic system, and I don't want to just dump piss and shit into my natural, beautiful waterways here. And so humanure is where it's at for my context. It doesn't necessarily make sense for everybody. Like, so, if I was on more pasture and I could get most of my fertility from my grazing animals, that's where I'd get my fertility. And it might make more sense in there to do a slightly different type of compost system, but I think it's great. And it's not as much work as people think it is. Like, it really, it's not a big deal. I spend 1 hour on average, call it every 4 weeks, 1 hour. That's it. So we poop and pee in buckets. We cover it with sawdust. We stockpile those buckets in an area. And then once a month or every 6 weeks, I just go out, I load all that stuff into the bioreactor. I rinse the buckets out, dump all that washing water. I just use a biodegradable soap, dump it in the bioreactor. I'm done. That's it. And then we just start the cycle again. So it's not a big deal. And it's more, it's in a way, flushing toilets are dependent on infrastructure. And you don't notice how convenient your toilet is until it doesn't flush. And so the advantage of a composting toilet is it's low tech, and it's super resilient because there's nothing that can really go wrong with the system besides from changing a bucket. So it's great.
Yeah. And I think also just, in line with permaculture, that you were touching on this earlier with the water and the wells as well, like, you want to reduce the amount of external inputs that you have and how much you dependency you have on external products or systems, et cetera. And, I had an RV the last couple of years that had a composting toilet. So that's why I first started experimenting with humanure and kind of collecting that. And at one of the urban farms that I was involved in, this community house in Houston, I started storing my poop there, and I hope they know it's still there being stored in some buckets. But another kind of addendum to that is that there are some people I've read who say that yes, humanure is good, but don't use it on plants that you're or trees that you're going to eat from. What are your thoughts on that?
That's bullshit. I mean, yeah, if your body's full of pharmaceuticals and heavy metals, maybe, but we're eating what we eat comes from the land here. So why wouldn't I want to poop? that those conversations are just because people don't want to be stigmatized. And, you know, full disclosure, when I was urban farming commercially, I wasn't using hoo manure, not because I didn't want to, but I didn't want the limited perspective ignorance of people to hurt my farm. So I didn't use hoo manure because, but up here, I'm no longer a commercial farmer. My hoo manure is 100% going on my vegetables and fruit trees, 100%. It would be silly to not use that. That's what this fertility is for. It's all about closing the loop. So people just say that because they don't want to be stigmatized, because it would be, you know, especially in a city with urban liberals who think they're so smart and know everything and don't do anything, they would go, oh, Curtis is pooping on my vegetables that I buy from him at the farmer's market. Oh my God, that's so bad. I wouldn't want to do that. They're just people who are ignorant, and that's all it is.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. So last question here, and this one is sort of a two-parter, but I think it feeds in nicely to some of the work that you're doing at From the Field. So someone wanted to know, do you have any resources for city people to ramp up quickly in how to grow food? And with that, any online courses or step-by-step books that you feel are the best for newbies?
Yeah, I mean, I have thousands of videos on that. So yeah, I would say, you know, if you want to get your feet wet with my work, you know, my urban farming work is actually very relevant to any gardening context, whether you're rural or urban. I actually am very, even though I'm not interested in being cities at all, I'm very proud of the work that I did as the urban farmer, because intensive gardening is the best way to garden, in my opinion. And even being somebody in a now totally rural environment where I have tons of space and I don't need to farm based on space like I was in the urban context, as I did, but I still do, because it's actually just more practical. Growing your annuals and doing either a bio-intensive or market gardening type context where you've got a concentrated bed, you know, it's typically a 30-inch bed, and you're doing, it's also based on French intensive farming, where you have, you know, crops spaced in such a way that when they're at 50 to 75% of their maturity, their foliage covers the soil. And so you plant things in an intensive way and you concentrate in beds that don't get walked on, instead of the typical rows where people have a row of crop, a single row, and then they have footpaths and then a row of crop. It's very inefficient. It's more efficient, even in a rural context, to grow intensively, because it means less irrigation infrastructure. It means less season extension infrastructure. It's a more economic way of using space. And then that way I can have, so like on my gardens that I'm designing here, I have, like, this is going to be a total permaculture playground. I'm going to have hundreds of trees, nuts, fruits, everything you can imagine. And that stuff is spaced accordingly, because I want those trees to express themselves as trees do. And I actually want that canopy to cover the ground. So I'm wide spaced with my perennials and I'm tightly spaced with my annuals. And so, yeah, all of my work is going to put people in that right direction, whether I'm in those videos, whether I'm in the city or I'm in the country, it doesn't matter. The information is universally applicable. And so, yeah, people could start on my YouTube channel. And if they want to become a paid member of From the Field, I guarantee the value is absolutely insane. We've basically set up From the Field to be an educational platform, in that because YouTube and platforms like that that are free, it's like any, you know, you guys in the tech space understand this. It's like if something's free, you're the product, right? Not YouTube's free because the analytics give so much to Google. And if you want to play within those algorithms, in order to be a successful content creator on YouTube, you have to accommodate those algorithms. But my platform From the Field doesn't have to follow those algorithms, because it's mine. It's decentralized. And the content is there. It's a massive encyclopedia. And all of my content is long form, where so much nuance is, like, for example, if I were to tell you, like, my 10 most valuable videos of my 1,000 videos on YouTube, they're the videos that are least seen, because they're long form and they deliver value that isn't subject to algorithms to make them trending on YouTube. And that's, I think that's one thing that people should consider when they're actually looking for information is that, like, you think you're getting a lot of value out of YouTube, but you might not be because you're not actually paying for it. And you're being directed by algorithms. Whereas private platforms, which I think is the future, especially as we move into this new paradigm, information, as we see through this whole censorship campaign, that's all directed by these cronies, the New World Order people, they want to compartmentalize you and compartmentalize you and compartmentalize you. And we haven't even seen how bad it's going to get, because eventually you're not even going to find anything that's useful on YouTube. It's just going to be like how to do your transgender makeup. Like, it's just, they just direct you in how they want you to go, because they just look at you as cattle. And so in order for us to, you know, get through this paradigm, we're going to have to support people's private platforms. And I'm not just saying this because I want people to sign up from the field and pay me money. I'm not saying that at all. I'm actually saying that from a philosophical and just practical perspective, is you need to support private platforms. And so that's community, right? And instead of giving your money to Netflix every month or buying a case of beer every week or whatever it is, put a few dollars and support private platforms, because that's where the quality is going to be. And when the great cyber pandemic shutdown happens, those are the only places you're going to get that information, and you're not even going to see us anymore. And so if people don't start actually taking account of where these private communities are, and you can find those things through Freedom Cells and through other, you know, independent groups, the lights are going to go out eventually, and guys like me are going to disappear from the public, and you're not even going to know about me unless you already know about me and you already know about my platform and know where to find it, because it could get to a point where guys like me can't even advertise on Google and Facebook anymore. And so that's why, you know, that's why I built From the Field, is because I saw this coming years ago, and I was way ahead of the curve. I have to say, like, I launched in 2019. So it's been 2 years running now, almost 2 years. And I'm glad I did. It was the best business move I ever did, but it's just from a practical standpoint, because I know this great Hail Mary of censorship is going to get even worse.
Absolutely. And they're great platforms. I want to encourage everybody to check Curtis out at theurbanfarmer.co and fromthefield.tv. I definitely agree with you wholeheartedly there, man, that, you know, I'm surprised you're still on YouTube, but I know you've tried to be strategic about how, yeah, exactly. I've seen you do that. But even with that, the reality is, like, you're not long for being deleted, you know, from YouTube. I was deleted last October. Plenty of other people have been, but I do want to encourage everybody to check them out where you can, while you can. And I hope you've enjoyed this conversation. I know I have, man. This has been really, really great. And just, I appreciate you letting me probe your mind a little bit. Any other closing thoughts you want to share before we go?
Yeah, man, I just want to give some gratitude to you and the work you do, because I think, it's incredibly important and timely. And I really, really was stoked that you reached out, and because I've been a fan of everything you do for a very long time. And so, or at least as long as you've been online. And yeah, I think people need to take action. Like, the time for thinking about this is over. Like, we are in this transitionary phase. I believe it all ties into this, what I refer to as a Great Awakening. And I know that was adopted by the Q movement and all that. I think all that stuff is just a psyop, but there's some fundamental truths in that. I think we are in a great awakening. And I think in order for us to move through this and survive, like, I want people to survive and thrive. First, you got to survive, and then you got to survive to thrive. And so part of that is making sure that you take as many steps as humanly possible to control your food, water, energy, and shelter. You don't have to do it alone. You can do it in a community. You can do it in all kinds of different ways. I've shown people how to do this stuff with cooperative farming, urban farming, low tech, cheap ways to do it. There's all kinds of ways to do it. There's many ways to win. There's an infinite amount of solutions out there. We are creators. We create. And when you start connecting into your creative capacity, and instead of going, looking at something and going, oh, well, Curtis is doing this because this, oh, I can't do that. Ask yourself, what do I have to do that? And what does success look like at the end? And then step backwards and go, okay, in order to get there, I got to be here first. And then in order to get there, I got to go here. So you step backwards. It's just like any entrepreneur who wants to create a business model. You start at the end and go, what's the dream? What's the vision? How much money do I want to make? And I don't mean to truncate this to a discussion of money, but it's just from a practical standpoint, you got to step backwards and go, okay, now what's step A? What do I do to, what do I have to do to get there? Ask yourself or ask God, what is it that I have to do? Too many people are afraid and have been lied to for so long that you are full of limiting beliefs that have been imposed on you through an indoctrination program of public schooling. We have so much unlearning to do, but most importantly, as we move through this paradigm, and I'm circling back to what I started with at the beginning, is we have to elevate our being into high frequency. And so that it's better to stay high frequency the more you're offline, because online, it's just a soup, especially if you're just cruising social media. I would encourage everybody to get off social media. Facebook, Twitter, total waste of time. Even being on the alternative platforms like Gab and Parler and all that, I don't really see a lot of upside to it. It's just a lot of yelling into an echo chamber or yelling at people who don't agree with you, and it's just a complete waste of time. If you want to be productive, you have to get involved in people in your community, and that's how you're going to step forward. And you have to elevate your whole spiritual existence has to be elevated. You do that through surrounding people that are good and share your values and are positive people who don't just sit there and talk shit and complain. Surround yourself with people who are doers, people who want to make a change, people who want to do something positive. Just surround yourself with those people. You have to eat good food, engage in the land, engage in nature. That's what we have to do, not only just for survival and our health, but to get through the next 10 years. The only way, when the mass trauma and the mass shocks come from all these cyber pandemics, cyber polygon, the outcome, the natural conclusion of this injection, and all this, these things, this is the New World Order's ultimate Hail Mary, and they're throwing everything at it. And I believe that that is happening. There's a spiritual reason that's happening, is because there is a natural great awakening happening. In conclusion, I think if you caught most of what I said there, the gist of it is that you have to stay in high frequency. You have to be surrounded with love and positive energy, because the external around you is going to get really harsh. And you can change things in your physical realm by like getting out of the city, changing your diet, changing the people around you. There's so many things you can actually do to keep yourself there. And then there's the practical stuff, growing food, controlling water, controlling your energy and all that. And we need to prepare for what's coming, because this thing that we're on is just going to get worse and worse and worse. But the more, the upside is that the more of those things you change into, the more available you're going to be for this awakening, where you move. I believe we are in this great opportunity, and the opportunity is to elevate to a new paradigm. And that's what the greater reset is fundamentally about. I think that that's kind of what I got from it. And that, you know, the New World Order is pushing the great reset, because they want to just flip the script on the natural hierarchy and centrally controlled paradigm that they have, the pyramidal structure, the infinite symbol of their movement. The greater reset is us embracing our own spirituality and creator capacity and moving into an evolved human that is more connected to nature, more connected to God, and more living within the regenerative capacity that nature is. Nature regenerates and builds on itself. Topsoil builds, forests grow. We need to do the same thing. It all connects to regenerative agriculture. It all connects to agorism. It all connects to anarchism. The permaculture community need to understand that more, that all these things are connected, and we can go into that, and we become this new elevated existence on this planet. And all these people living in these cities are going to look to us like a de-evolved or unevolved new species. And there's going to be an absolute bifurcation in 10 years, what human beings look like who live in the cities versus what human beings look like in the country connected to nature. We're going to be a completely bifurcated thing. It's going to be incredible. And I think there's a huge opportunity in this for all of us.
Wow, so much good stuff there, brother. And I agree with you 100%. Like, I've been calling it the fracturing that I think we're witnessing, of the fracturing between the people who get the shot and don't get the shot, the people in the city and the people outside the city, the people who buy into the, you know, it's just, we're going to see it in so many different ways. But I appreciate you taking the time today. And I hope everybody listening to this really takes home the message that this is an opportunity. Everything we've witnessed in the last year and a half is an opportunity for us to move towards the things that we want to see in the world. And that's what I've always told myself as well. It's like, sometimes I have to ask myself, maybe I'm just crazy. Maybe I am just buying into right-wing propaganda. Maybe this isn't real. You know, and in those moments, I'm like, well, even if today, if I realized, oh, I bought into a bunch of propaganda and none of it's real. Well, okay, what was the cost of that? I moved towards growing my own food. I learned to take better care of myself. I learned to eat healthy, you know. So ultimately, we're moving in a direction that I think we all want to go in, and that's the positive thing. So thank you again so much for being with us today. Everybody at home, please check out Curtis at theurbanfarmer.co and fromthefield.tv. And of course, you can find the Activation Podcast at theconsciousresistance.com. Thanks for listening. And as always, remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free. Peace. Thank you for listening to the Activation Podcast, brought to you by the Conscious Resistance Network. You can find the archives of our show on Spotify, Pinecast, and at theconsciousresistance.com.